Hey, this is Nick from BJJ Pandas.
This is Vic.
And we are back. So, hey, if you're listening for the first time, just thank you for coming and joining us. Appreciate that. If you've been a listener since the beginning, gonna make a slight apology. We took a break. So, last episode you heard was back in April. Now we are in September, almost October, and we haven't been able to really produce a whole lot of content for you. So, a lot of things going on. This episode number... whatever the number is. It was uploaded today. I think it's like 32.
Something like that.
Actually walks through why we haven't been around and talks about the journey that we've had as we go through. So if you're new to the podcast, welcome. Hopefully you enjoyed it. It's an amazing podcast. Lots of cool stuff. If you've been listening forever, guys, we love you. Thank you so much for listening. I've heard you. I've been getting messages and people telling me, where's the podcast? I miss Monday mornings. We're back. We are absolutely back and back for at least the duration. So we do have, you'll notice a little bit of an audio degradation. If you listen to some of the original content, it sounds like complete shit. And then if you listen to like episode 4 through something, it sounds much better. And then if you listen to, at some point, the episodes, they sound really, really good. And now we're kind of back to the much better stage because my board broke.
We'll get it back.
If I had that board, I'd make like a wah, wah, wah. So yeah. I don't have that board. So hopefully we're going to get that back here pretty soon, and the audio quality will go back to where it was. But the content has always been amazing.
Yeah. So welcome back, guys.
Welcome back. Hey, real quick, just want to plug a couple of things we have going on. So do want to just give a shout out to Triple Crown MMA. So that's the gym that both Vic and I train out of under Jordan Sullivan. So really excited to be there. But do want to do a couple of shameless promotional plugs.
Yeah, I have to. Got to.
All right. Well, as long as you guys are okay with it. Not going to be like a JRE episode where I plug everything in the entire world. Well, not everything.
Yeah.
So BJJ Pandas. Guys, you all had inspired me to start a line of gis and no-gi wear. My wife also started Shadow Realm BJJ with Elisa Hampton, so super excited. We have a full line of gear. So we have gis, we have rash guards, we have shorts.
The whole shebang.
Everything. You want it, we got it. Well, not everything.
Not most.
Just
most
about
things.
Everything. Just about anything. Okay. We do patches, we do shirts, we do hoodies, hats. Pretty much whatever you'd want if you're practicing BJJ.
We have slides.
We have slides. We don't really have slides.
Well, we can't... Working on.
I tried them. They weren't great. I don't want to sell them. We're good.
We're working it out.
We're also working on boxing gloves and shin guards for our striking fans. A lot of cool stuff. If you head over to bjjpandas.com, you're going to see a great website that actually has a bunch of links. One of those links is to all the previous podcasts. You'll be able to see those. There's also a link to our gear. So if you click on products, you can go to bjjpandasgear.com/store, which is a lot to remember. So just go to bjjpandas.com. And you'll be able to see a full line of all the different products that we offer. You can pick them up in person if you're in the tri-state, Kentucky, Cincinnati area. Or you can get them sent to you because we ship. So that's certainly a thing. Credit card, PayPal, whatever you want to use. And guys, we are so excited to be back. I'm excited. We have this BJJ Pandas line, Shadow Realm line of gear that is going out all over the country. We have schools that are supporting the line throughout the country by using us as their provider of their gear for their academies. And we have them all over here in Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, all over the place. So we are everywhere, and we're really, really excited. The other thing I'd ask, and I think Vic asks more than I do, is if you want to share your story, let us know. Go on to bjjpandas.com, click the contact us, shoot me a message on Instagram, shoot me a message on Facebook, BJJ Pandas, Shadow Realm, BJJ, either one, and click, like it, follow us. Do all the things you do on social media, and we're going to grow this thing to be huge.
So we want your story.
We do. I want your story. Vic wants your story. Our audience wants your story.
We all want it.
Everybody wants to hear your journey. Guys, so with that, hopefully you enjoy the episodes. Let us know what you think, and we'll talk to you all soon. Welcome to another episode of BJJ Panda Journeys, Stories from the Mat. Typically, right now, you'd be listening to a clip from the podcast episode. This particular episode, I couldn't find just one clip that really did a good job encapsulating the entire interview. And this is actually our longest interview yet to date. This is almost 2 hours. And I'm really excited because this is an awesome guest. Can't wait for you guys to hear it. Any comments, let us know. Please sit back, enjoy, and have a great time listening. Welcome back to BJJ Panda Journeys, Stories from the Mat. I'm Nick.
I'm Vic.
And today's kind of an interesting episode. We're actually all in
remote. So we're all remote. Hopefully Vic's audio will come in good, but you're going to see Vic's wonderful face. I don't know if we're going to post this anywhere on YouTube or anything. I doubt we will. But you know, just in case we've got some video. So this next guest that we have is one that I've been waiting for quite a while. I mean, this is one that I reached out to this person. She kind of became Insta famous on Instagram and all over social media. And just, you know, out of nowhere, I said, you know, it'd be amazing to have this person on, but I'm sure they're getting flooded with just hundreds of messages. But I'm going to shoot one out there anyway, see what happens. And almost an instant response of absolutely love to be on the show. And I'm just so grateful for that and of that. But today we have with us Betty Broadhurst. Hi, Betty.
Hey, how are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great, thanks. So for those that don't know, if you've been living under a rock or completely ignoring all social media, Betty had the opportunity to get promoted to black belt at the very young age of, I think it was 63, Betty?
65
years old, after a competition and getting gold, all right? So blew up all over the internet. double gold. So it blew up all over the internet. And I'll tell you, being an older practitioner myself, I think our listeners know I'm 41. We play with Vic, who's 19. But it was just amazing to me to have somebody inspirational almost that not only did you get the promotion to black belt, right? Because that's a huge accomplishment.
Yes.
But during a massive world stage where you're able to take double gold, it kind of gives me goosebumps. And I was like, oh, that is just so cool. And our whole gym's kind of buzzing with it. It's like, oh, did you see? Like, look at this. So I got to tell you, thank you first off for being on. I'm absolutely honored to have you on the podcast.
You so much for inviting me. And like I said earlier, I'm the same person I was before. I'm just go and train, which I've been doing for 10 years. And, you know, it's just that somebody posted it on Instagram and then somebody else posted it. And, you know, I think good news travels. And I think what happened to me was good news in a time in a year that we've all needed some uplifting stories and positivity. So I'm really glad that I could help, you know, brighten somebody's day and give us something positive to talk about it at our gyms rather than, are we going to have to lock down or, you know, negative things that we've all gone through the last 18 months to 2 years.
It's been a tough couple of months.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I think we've all experienced it to different degrees, right? I work with folks out in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, New York was locked down forever. California was locked down forever. So, well, Betty, before we get too far into it, I know that you have an organization. I don't know if you want to talk about that real quick, because some people kind of get into the podcast and they bounce out 10, 15 minutes in. So before we get too deep, if you want to just talk about it real quick.
Okay. And it's called Roll Forever. In fact, it's very basic. I guess when I was a purple belt, I started, and I was training in North Carolina at the time. I started I have to tell this part of the story. I've been competing since white belt. So that was one of the things I wanted to do to get better, was to compete. So I was training at a gym in North Carolina. And by the time I was blue belt and I was still competing and I was traveling with friends, teams, I was going to open mats. So my community went outside my gym as far as like my contacts. So I went with a group of women, I believe it was in Northern Virginia or Maryland, to a Naga. I mean, you know, you post it, new breed, Naga, whatever, I'll go. You know, I was like, let's go. And I could get into more about why later, but I remember going and sitting in the stands waiting for my time. And I don't even remember what year this is. It was probably 2014, something like that. And this lady was sitting beside me or once seat behind me. And she said, oh, you're about my age and you're competing. And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, that's great. She said, I drive up and down the East Coast bringing my sons to compete. And so we started chatting. And she said, I said, where are your sons? She said, one's a brown belt over there or purple belt over there in a gi, the tall, skinny guy. And then the other's a little short, plump kid, you know, in the yellow and gray, or I'm not good with kids'
I love the descriptive words. Plump is great.
Plump is a good description word.
When my brother, when I have one brother, and he used to always have to wear husky pants. That's what they called them.
Yep.
That was me.
I know that
line. I was wearing husky.
Husky, yeah. But, and so I said, that's great. And she said, you know, I don't think they have anyone, you know, older. They tried to get me to train, yada, yada. Or it ends up, by the end of our conversation, we ended up getting a hot dog together and chatting, you know, after my match. She went over and watched my match. And it ends up, it was Gordon and Nikki Ryan's mother. And we became really good friends and Facebook friends. She invited me to come up and train. And I love no gi also. And this is before they were, anybody really knew who they were. You know, they were winning everything, even at that level, but, you know, on the small circuits. So I think when Gordon was a brown belt, I asked him, would he come down to my gym and do a seminar and bring his mom? And that way he could get paid. Because, you know, she said he was doing private lessons, working part-time, you know, on side jobs and starting to train up at Henzo's for about a year. So we set it up, and they drove down from New Jersey. Nikki came with them, and they did a seminar. But about 3 weeks before the seminar, and I had talked to them about it probably 4 months in advance so that I could advertise it. And a lot of people said, I don't know who it is. And I said, well, he trains with Gary Kamen, so you know he's really good, you know. So I convinced my coach, let's have it, posted it, you know, on Facebook. I don't even think I was on Instagram back in those days. And told a lot of people at other open mats about it. And some, and people that were really deep into the no-gi world had heard of him. He had started winning some of the stuff like Subversive and some of the circuits that were in the Philadelphia, you know, New York, you know, Triangle, some of those smaller things. But anyway, what happened is Gary was in 3 weeks before the seminar, he was promoted to black belt. And then Gary was injured and was supposed to appear on an EBI. So instead of Gary going, they asked Gordon, it was EBI absolute. So he stepped up, went to the Eddie Bravo, I think it was in LA, the EBI absolute. It was back when they were at the Orpheum, the original EBIs, and he won. And all of a sudden, he was kind of an overnight sensation. And then 3 weeks later, I have him in my little rural gym.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So from there on, I decided that, you know, this is a good way, because we had a lot of people come. The good thing is that everybody at the gym learned a lot of skills that they would have never had the opportunity. A lot of them couldn't afford to go to stay at Henzo's or pay the fee, you know, to go up and train somewhere like that. As I had said, these guys were scrambling to make money and to try to make money. So it was one of these things that it helps them also. I said, well, you know, this is a pretty cool thing. Maybe I should do this again. So I did. So Nikki came back with Ethan Krellenstein about a year later to compete in a local tournament. And by then they were training at John's and whatever. And so I had a seminar, and the two of them were brown belts, I guess. And they had a seminar, and it was packed because by then people started hearing about it. But local people got the information. They made money off of it. And so I said, this is great. So I had different gyms where I had gone to open mats in North Carolina and Virginia. I would say, yeah, you're welcome to use our gym. And I'd say, fine, that way you can advertise that you're hosting, you know, and my company. By then, you know, people would always ask me, how long do you plan to train, Betty? And I said, well, I plan to roll forever. So I said, okay, I'm just going to call this little, like, roll forever promotions or whatever. So I would contact an athlete and say, would you mind coming to North Carolina or Virginia or South Carolina, and whoever I knew that would offer me the gym. And then I would promote it. And so I kind of did this as a side gig to help the athletes and to help the community. I didn't make any money off of it. I mean, I wasn't in it for that, but it was a way to bring a lot of people together. And it helped raise the level of jiu-jitsu in our area, because I wanted people to learn, not just me, but there were brown and black belts. I wanted them to learn. So when I would go to their school or I would go to their open mat, they could break it down, you know, because I was still a blue belt. I don't think I was a purple belt yet. Yeah, I think I did. I got my purple belt somewhere in between. But it went on that I had Bernardo Feria, JT Torres, Keenan came over. Keenan Cornelius came. Clark Gracie. Gordon came back after ADCC, the first ADCC. And this time I had to get the biggest gym I could find because by then, yeah, it was unbelievable.
I can imagine.
Him and his mom and his girlfriend, he had a girlfriend then, Nat. And so they came and we got an Airbnb and had a really fun weekend and he made some money and we went out to eat and she and I, and so I've been up and trained with them, you know, several times. I've gone up to New Jersey.
Let's go. I need to go back real quick. Cause something struck me and I just want to touch on this topic. So the woman who was there that you met was there to compete and in the same age bracket. So probably 40 plus, right? Cause they don't really,
there driving her son.
Okay. Okay. I was thinking that Gordon and Nikki Ryan's mom also did jiu-jitsu. Yeah. I was like, oh yeah.
Just the wheels, you know.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Very
and
cool,
going
very
to video cool. Her kids, you know. She was like soccer mom, you know.
Well, so my wife started that way, right? So my daughter, my youngest daughter, mm-hmm. she's five. She started competing when she was four. She turns four in March, and she was supposed to do her very first Fuji tournament was going to be March, I think like 6th or 7th, and she turns four on March 4th. So we had it all set up. And you can't compete until you're at least four. So she was going to be the youngest competitor on the mats. You know, she turned four a couple days ago. And it was literally that weekend that Corona hit, or it was like the weekend after it hit this area and everything got shut down. So she didn't get to compete. Like it kind of all fell apart.
Yeah. It put a lot of people's, jiu-jitsu climbing the ladder on hold. It stifled a lot of people. A lot of people have not come back they left, you know, and I think a lot of gyms closed. And I mean, I'm just repeating things that we all know are common knowledge, but
yeah, it was a struggle.
Yeah.
So it was a struggle. I'll tell you for, oh, go ahead.
Became a seminar hosting type thing. And the money that I would make, you know, so it ended up when the names got bigger, you know, what I would do, I would contact the athlete. They have a fee. And once you cover their house, their lodging, transportation, and then, you know, you do the tickets. I got an Eventbrite account under Roll Forever and then would host it. Well, there was money left over. So I started sponsoring athletes, like, let me help you register for the next tournament, because I'm a pharmacist by profession and I was working full time and training. I'm divorced, been divorced for years, like 20 some years. And my kids are grown through college and all. So I have everything I need. So to me, it was, you know, I wasn't looking to make money out of this. I wanted to do something to help jiu-jitsu. And so I started sponsoring a couple of local athletes. Well, then I realized that some of the bigger name athletes were struggling. If you weren't a big name like, you know, JT or Keenan, it was really hard to get a seminar. I mean, you know, if you were just somebody like that, were you were on the cutting edge, you were like not quite there yet where you were a household name. So a couple of the guys that I knew gave me names. Trish Ryan, Gordon's mom. Her house was always like a boarding house because there were people always coming down from Canada staying with these guys so they could go train at Henzo's, and they would come stay. Her basement actually had two sets of bunk beds. She was like the Airbnb of jiu-jitsu. She has such a good heart. I mean, she wouldn't charge them anything. These were son's friends, and they would come in and stay, you know, come in and stay for 2 to 3 weeks, and then they would go back to Canada. So I got to know a lot of the Canadian athletes that were struggling, trying to, you know, make it. And I started sponsoring a couple of them as far as like helping with their travel, helping with their registration for things. And from there, it got it got bigger and the seminars got fewer because things started happening where I think BJJ Fanatics had not taken off. And so once things like that, the attendance seminars started dropping. I think that there was a correlation with being able to watch something in your home versus paying the $100 fee to come see Bernardo Ferrier when you can have him in your living room 24/7. And so I got more focused on the athletes, but then I said, okay, I still got to figure out a way to make money to help finance these guys. So started doing just basic training gear. I guess you could compete in it, but it's nothing but basic black rash guard shorts, because the majority of my athletes are no gi, and the female, I have two female athletes that I sponsor, and they compete in no gi also. And this hoodie and a pair of sweatpants. I've done a couple of limited edition things, like one of the athletes I sponsor is Felicia O, who's one of the Dirty Dozen women. And I post a whole lot about her on my Instagram because she's my mentor. She's a Jean-Jacques Machado black belt. And she and Eddie Bravo grew up together in the ranks. So, and she's still an active competitor as a Master 5. And she's one of the people that was behind me throughout my whole journey. My first Masters tournament was in 2015. So I've been going to World Masters since 2015. So, and I knew her from then. But anyway, and that was a blue belt back then. And because there's a lot of chat rooms and stuff on Facebook for Masters women, everybody looking for a match, or women that are just starting. But I was one of the early women that, I don't want to say early women in jiu-jitsu, but early older women, you know, that chose to start the journey at an older age. But I'm going to wrap up about Roll Forever. My thought process, I'll get going off tangents if you don't pull me back in. But so we... one of the athletes is very good with websites. We set up a website. So I don't try to compete with anyone as far as like for gear, but I still offer seminar production for any of my athletes that I sponsor to help them make money. And then the gear we sell, 100% of the profits go. You know, I have someone that, like you and I were speaking of earlier, that makes the basic gear, and it's just our basic logo. And it's just rash guard shorts and this. Felicia is a graphic art designer, and she did a Roll Forever thing. It was like a tunnel thing with multicolors of all the belts. And we did a women's limited edition rash guard one time, you know, and it sold out. And because it appealed to a certain audience. But other than that, and all the monies from that, you know, went toward sending our athletes to things like the ADCC trials. I had like three athletes at the trials this past year, and then to Worlds No Gi, and to also Masters Worlds. And so it's been really beneficial. I mean, and now I retired this past December. I'm not working anymore. I know. After all the winning, I said, okay, I can retire now. But that was like my goal was like, I really wanted to do, now I could put 100% of myself into training jiu-jitsu. I'm teaching a couple of classes now for my professor. I've filled in for him a couple of times since, and which really makes me feel good. I was a little nervous being older, but it's really funny how much respect and kindness that I've been given. And the other thing is Roll Forever, actually has its own Instagram account. And you can look at the gear on there and the athletes that wear it. I post a lot of the athletes' clips. We also try to sponsor events. If I have any extra money, like Fight to Win or Grapple Fest, I try to sponsor events, because if you don't have sponsors for events, the athletes have nowhere to compete. And they rely on sponsors to rent arenas, you know, to pay all the production cost and all to have these things. So. It's kind of a three-prong thing. I try to sponsor events when, you know, when we're able, sponsor the athletes, and then we run the website, and I still book seminars. Like right now, a lot of my athletes are training for the trials, and then IBJJF, I think Austin Nogi, but any of the athletes, if anyone wants a seminar from them, they are more than happy. All you do is just contact me on the website and I set it up. I have Oliver Taza, Ethan Crellinston, Diego Bispo, who is my professor, but he is also a Gi world champion and a no-Gi world champion multiple times. Let's see. They're the two Canadians, Ethan and Oliver. And then Pierre Leclerc, who is Canadian and trains out of TriStar. And he is probably the first one that I started working with. He was coming down to work a lot at Kenzo's, but having to go back to Montreal like every 2 weeks. And he has become phenomenal. He actually, in the East Coast trials, made it to the final six and lost to William Tackett by decision. So he's really, really good.
That's a good person to lose to.
Yeah,
if you're gonna lose, you might as well lose to somebody worthwhile, right?
Right.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And so, guys, listen, if you want to buy any gear and support what Betty has going on, I think Roll Forever, fantastic from all the work you're doing. One of the things that I really enjoy about that story is that it was designed and continues to be designed to help people. And I think in the jiu-jitsu community, that's a lot of what I've seen. I mean, I've only been doing this for a few years. But that's what I've seen. And I think, you know, even with the organization or the company that my wife and I started with Elisa, the intent there wasn't, we're going to be rich. Like, we're just going to make millions of dollars. The intent was, hey, we found there's a need. People need a specific shadow. Yeah.
And it helps people be able to have something comfortable to wear where they can perform at their best. And by having that, and it's like you said, it's not, I think that we all are in jiu-jitsu. Once you're involved in it, it takes a certain kind of person. And I think once you're involved and you understand that community and brotherhood that I don't know what other word to describe it, it extends beyond your own gym. It becomes to where your opponent is your friend, because without your opponent, you wouldn't be able to compete. So, you know, you just, and that's what I was saying, why I was got very gung-ho about competing. Because I would sign up for these smaller tournaments and there would never be a woman my age. There'd be women my belt rank. There'd be women my weight class, but never my age. But I kept showing up because I know what that feeling is like to want to compete and not have anybody. And so once I became purple belt, there are very few purple belts that do the smaller circuit. They start doing a lot of the bigger circuits, or they get rare, you know. It's kind of like a zebra. They start get the higher it goes, the more rare sure. it gets. Yeah. So I would always show up. I would sign up first. And no matter who was in front of me, I would go, because I thought if I wasn't here, she wouldn't have an opponent today. And I may not be, you know, she's probably going to beat me. And most of the times I did get beat, because a lot of the girls were 18 to 20, you know, 25. Sure. But they had to work for it. I mean, I trained hard and I worked hard, and it didn't do anything but help me get better, help me find out where the holes were in my game. And a lot of the holes in my game are due to age, flexibility, mobility, and they didn't offer jiu-jitsu when I was their age. I mean, it wasn't even in the U.S. You know, it's a relatively new sport, as we all know, in the U.S. I mean, some of the black belts in North Carolina and Virginia, the ones that have established schools, tell me about how they would drive on weekends, leave on Thursday night and go to New York and train at Henzo's and come back on an early or late Sunday night or Monday morning, work all week and go back in order to get their blue belt or purple belt. Then they would be teaching in a garage to a bunch of people. Because, and if you found somebody in North Carolina, purple belt, man, that was something. I mean, and this is like the stories they tell us about the late 90s, the early 2000s.
Yeah. Because, that's even today. I mean, yeah, so we have a sponsored athlete.
You're exactly right.
Marissa Pender. We had her on last week. She's a black belt now. And she said when she started training, she couldn't fathom having a woman black belt, you know, anywhere. They just didn't exist. Exactly. We go to Tennessee. We're part of Team Sean Hammonds. We go to Tennessee for team training. So we'll get, you know, anybody who's Team Sean Hammonds, welcome to come. And, you know, we probably get a couple hundred people show up. And there's like five, six upper belt women. So I'm thinking of brown to black belt.
Right.
They just they're not there. And now Marissa actually has two black belts in her gym that are coaches. They're women. So it's, but to your point, it's still so rare to see women in the sport period. I think we're starting to see more of that, but especially, you know, that have lasted throughout and continued to do it for, you know, the 10 or 15 years it takes to get to that level and get that level of experience.
Yeah. And I think the blossoming of the kids programs, you know, that was kind of when local gyms started opening. To be honest, the kids programs were a good, as we all know, it's one of the best sports for children due to the discipline and structure and the anti-bullying aspects. But it helped a lot of parents, I think, as far as making sure their kids were safe and in a good environment, you know, and it allowed kids to start early, just like the Rutilo brothers, you know, that started as children. So now these 18-year-old, and they have to wait until they're a certain age to even compete at blue belt. You know, they can be juvenile, blue belt, whatever. 16. And they're out there, like, let's say Cole Abate, you know, I mean, he's whipping everybody, and he's like a blue belt under the Mendez brothers. But, you know, it's just a whole different transition in the last 10 years. We are seeing these kids that were 6 years old, they're now 16. You know, in the last 10 years. And they are the ones that are beating all the older people that didn't start training until they were young adults.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I have a 4-year-old, and we always, so Vic is actually our kids coach at our gym. And his sister Bella, she competes and she trains as well. She just turned 18. Vic's 19. His dad's actually from Brazil and trained in Brazil a long time ago, came here, kind of stopped training for the last, you know, a little bit. We pick on Flavio all the time because
he hasn't trained. Yeah. I caught up to him in belt rank. Funny.
He did. Vic's finally the same purple belt with his dad.
Higher. I have 2 stripes. He doesn't have any stripes.
Oh. I don't think they do. They didn't do stripes back then. I mean, that was like forever. They barely had belts at that point. They were still wearing loincloths and and deer capes. But no, so Vic teaches their kids class. He's our head kids instructor, and he teaches my daughter, my 4-year-old. Now she's 5, but it's, you know, we always talk about what's she going to be like when she's 16, how's she going to roll when she's 16, 17. And you look around and see the consistency, right? So same thing as blue belt blues, people leave it at blue belt. And we've seen a lot of kids come and go in just a couple, 3-4 years that I've been at the gym. We've seen just this rotation of kids. And I think it's common, right? Most kids find something.
Exactly.
But when you have that kid,
really, you see these standouts, and it's like anything else. I have a granddaughter, and she's done everything from gymnastics, cheerleading. They kind of float ballet. Mm-hmm. They float from one thing to another. So they haven't really, she's doing soccer, you know, they haven't really found themselves. And some kids are like that. Then some fall in love with it, especially, I think, if there's a parent or a figure in their life that is involved. You see, they are the ones, because they're there with their dad or mom. They see their dad and mom training. And I think at those formative years, they want to be like mom and dad when they grow up. So I think that that impacts a lot of the longevity with the kids. One of my old teammates, her father was in the Navy. And so they were stationed here in Norfolk, Virginia. And so we were on the same team in North Carolina and Virginia. So we trained a lot together. And she was only 12 or 13 years old, but she could beat me up. I mean, when I was a blue and purple. And it's Jessica Kahn. She ended up moving when her father got transferred back to the California Naval Base. She went back and started retraining again. She started at AOJ when she was a little bitty kid. And then her dad in the Navy got transferred to Norfolk, Virginia. So she was here with us for about 4 or 5 years, then went back. And look at her. I mean, you know, awesome. She's a household word. But she's just one. But she did, when she was here in Virginia, she took wrestling in high school. I mean, she was always trying to improve her skills in every spare time. She had very self-disciplined. Was homeschooled, so very, you know, structured as far as her life. And her father was military, Navy, and he also trained. And so, you know, I think a lot of the parental or the whoever the person that with that child, whether it be a big brother, you know, little brother, or a parent, has an impact on the longevity for them.
Oh, for sure. that influence. So speaking of starting the journey, mm-hmm. right? Because everybody's on that journey. So you started, you said about 10 or so years ago?
Yeah, I was 54.
Mm-hmm. So 54 years. So I'm super curious to understand, at 54, how did you pick up jiu-jitsu? Like, what was the thing that said, I'm going to go do this grappling sport?
Okay. I think at 54, I'm working full time. And like I said, I was single. Kids were in college. One was in college. One was in the last year of college. My daughter went to college in California, and I lived in a community near the beach in Wilmington, North Carolina. So my daughter wanted to go to college, and she was in a surf club from high school. And so she wanted to go to California to out-of-state college. So she was gone. My son was like already in his last year of college and working part-time and girlfriend. So, you know, you reach this point in your life where you're kind of like, okay, I'm not young anymore. And your peers from work, just depending on what kind of work you do, but you have certain peers that have a lot in common. Like they have kids on soccer teams and they carpool or go to the same schools. So you find yourself, as you get older, your niche gets kind of smaller. And the friends that I did have were starting to do things like, well, we play golf. Then
the face you made when you said that, like, that's so boring.
Wait, it gets better. And then they had a book club, and then, you know, I'm like, and a wine tasting, you know, every Friday night, you know, get together and have wine tasting. It was fun, but all I was doing was like sitting on my butt eating cheese crackers and, you know, drinking wine, or I was like reading a book. And trying to, and it's not that I didn't enjoy it, but I found myself like something's missing. And I still, and then you start getting around some of the women that were older than me, like I'm 54, but there were some women up to 60, and some of these clubs were starting to look at assisted living homes and talking about where they were going to go, sell their home and downsize and try to move to be near their kids. And I went, whoa. That's not, the nest just got empty and I'm looking for something better, you know, I've still got some growth in me, you know, as far as like, I mean, my mind is clear. I'm financially comfortable. I have a good job and this isn't what I want to talk about. You know, this isn't me. And so it's not that it wasn't anything, it's just the age that I was, and that is what people do. I mean, you know, when you hit 60, you have to start thinking about those things. Like,
oh heck, at 49 you get the AARP letter.
They start membership at 55, and then you start getting letters at age 62. You can legally like start drawing Social Security at age 62, and so, you know, you're already getting, you know, mail and information about that. But I just thought, I feel good, I'm healthy, and I played some tennis, but there's something about playing tennis and getting in car and driving off that, you know, you don't feel a bond or anything, even though these were good friends and everything. It's not the kind of thing that I want. So for some reason I decided, I work at the hospital. I'm a hospital pharmacist. So a lot of times I would work shifts, and I think we had a couple of cars broken in. And they were telling people, you know, you may want to make sure you have a security guard walking to your car and things like that. So I saw an ad that there was a free self-defense seminar, women only. I thought, well, that's cool. I might meet some women my age or women and learn a few things. Because I ran track and played softball and, you know, did whatever I could do. My kids played soccer. I would get out in the yard and play soccer. So I thought, well, that might be something I can meet some women that, you know, and also it'll serve a good purpose because of what was happening. So I went, it was in a church community building, and a jiu-jitsu school was two black belts and a couple of brown belts did the thing. We wore sweatpants, sweatshirts. You partnered up with someone similar to your size, and they did the typical bear hug escape, trap and roll. If you're, you know, on top, things like that. Some women didn't, I could tell, didn't like it or didn't like the physical activity. I just somehow felt very empowered with it. There was something about being able to push somebody off of me and roll up and stand up in a gracious stand up and escape, you know, just felt, wow. I mean, I've never had a sport where I could do anything like that. And I have had friends that carry a gun, but for self-protection. And so I remember going back after and enjoying it and telling the professors there that I enjoyed it. And they gave you the little business cards, and you know, it's a marketing thing, of course, but it was good information. And I remember going back talking to some of my friends at work about it. And they go, well, why would you do that? Just get a gun and carry it in your pocketbook. And see, now, you know, I go, like, after you've gone to jiu-jitsu, you know, like, how, what kind of chance do you have with a gun in your pocketbook? I mean,
yeah. Hey, hang on. Can you just wait right 1 minute? I got to get my pocketbook to get my gun out. Do you mind just hanging out for me?
It's a very false sense of security. But until you had gone to that self-defense course, you don't think about that. I mean, you know, I mean, I think these women that had never seen anything like that, if you're standing there with your pocketbook and someone grabs you from behind and pushes you in a car, you're done. And you're,
I would say, even if, yeah, even so I train with weapons as well, and did for a long time. It was a hobby. And even there, there's a 21-foot rule, right? So if you're less than 21 feet away to be able to draw and get, you know, get a good sight picture and get an appropriate shot, you can't do it in 21 feet. So if you're less than 7 yards, a gun is becomes much, much, much less effective. And to your point, if somebody comes up behind you and they, you know, get you in a bear hug or you know, choke you or whatever, yeah, gun or no gun, you're in trouble.
Much better to bend over and grab their leg and knee bar them, you know, the
when you're in the bear hug. Imanari roll.
Yeah, exactly. But so I decided from then, I think I want to learn more about the sport. So called up, made an appointment, met with one of the instructors. And the thing, they were very receptive to me, regardless of my age. It was a gym located near the beach. And so it was kind of a surf dudes and jiu-jitsu, which kind of go hand in hand in some areas, sure, like on the West Coast. But we were in North Carolina on the coast. But I thought, well, you know, they all were laid back. So I think it was a good place for very accepting atmosphere, you know, no, there weren't judgmental or anything like that. So I was very nervous and expressed to them about going into a group because I did have a lot of self-confidence problems. I think after going through a divorce and then, you know, trying the dating scene and not liking going through all that again,
I start losing
self-confidence as a person. Sure. So I didn't particularly like the idea of stepping when you were explaining group, you know, like but beginners gi advanced. And I went, oh my God, how many people are in there? About 25, 30. Oh no, I can't do that. You
know? And it's intimidating. I mean, it really is. It can be.
And lessons learned from that is that I make an extra effort to introduce myself to new students and shake their hand and thank them for coming. And is there anything I can help you with, you know, when you come back? Just because I know what it felt like. And it's kind of like when you're a kid and that new kid in class whose parents moved middle of the school year, and how when they walk in, the principal brings them in and all eyes are on you. You know, it's a horrible feeling. So
it is weird. I remember when we first started. So my wife, she trains as well, and I train, my two kids train. And when we first started going to the gym, it's a really awkward experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that just by the nature of it, right, you're getting manipulated and choked and, you know, right, you have the opportunity to get hurt significantly. And you're really reliant on your training partners and your coaches to make sure that that doesn't happen. That you don't get severely injured. So there's a trust factor there that you don't build for a while.
No.
And it takes time. But once you build those bonds, they're super strong. So when somebody comes in from the outside, to your point, that person hasn't gotten that trust yet. They haven't worked any of that. So it's a really awkward kind of stage.
They don't know what
to
expect. They don't. Yeah. If jiu-jitsu is new, now maybe if they transferred from another gym, that's a different story, you know?
Even then, though, even then I feel like
in a similar
when they walk in,
like,
I feel like when they walk in though, even from a different gym, it's still like, oh, well, they're not part of our group.
Yeah.
Like, there's still that kind of feeling of, and we try to make people as comfortable as possible. Cause we, you know, recently we've had a couple of people come from different gyms through the holidays and things, especially.
Yeah.
And it's still, you try really hard to make them feel comfortable, but they're still the quiet one on the mat. You know, and then once you get to know them, they open up and it gets much more comfortable, but it's definitely a longer
curve. Yeah, it takes a while to get to get that click, you know, going.
Yeah.
But I told the instructor, I need a slower pace to get into this. So he said, why don't we do this? Why don't we do private lessons for like 8 weeks? If you want to come on Wednesday and Saturday, because we have a beginner or we have an all levels class on Saturday, and then we have a beginner class on Wednesday. So I would come for a private lesson, and with that particular instructor, he was a brown belt, and just to start learning the positions. And I wasn't afraid of like the learning mount or learning to do a knee bar. I mean, the touch thing has never bothered me. And I don't know, maybe it's because it has to do with age. And after you've given birth to two kids, you lose all modesty. I mean, you know, maybe that's,
you just don't care. I don't know. I mean,
you know, some women are really like about the touchy feely stuff, or I'm very fortunate in that I don't have any issues that would trigger, you know, some bad memories or anything. But sure. So I didn't have a problem with that. But it was done while there was someone at the desk. And what happened is he would bring someone from the oncoming class that was coming up to ask them to come early to be my uki. So every Wednesday and Saturday, somebody from the class that they were going to have before my after my lesson would come early to be my partner. So he rotated everybody. So by the end of the 8 weeks, I had probably met 10 to 15 of the people that were in the class that I would be attending.
That is really so smart.
It was,
was that by design? Yeah,
very tactical, thought out plan that he did. So
that was completely by design. Like he did it very by intentionally.
Design. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's genius.
It was very nice.
That's really
because
smart.
Had I just done the private lessons with just him, and number one, it helped having the uki so he could watch and correct me. As we all know, you know, in a private lesson, and I've learned from the athletes that I sponsor, they do privates. They like for the person buying the private to bring a partner so they can touch, correct, watch, because you can't do that while you're the person being the uki. So when it was time for me to start the group the next month, I started the group. It was like, I had already joked and had coffee with a couple of the people, you know, I had, you know, had water breaks with them, talked to them about my kids and where they lived. And there were two women that were college students in the class. And then the rest of the guys were aged all the way up. I think maybe the oldest person was 40, but you know, I was able to jump right in and do shrimps and, you know, do the warm-up drills at the beginning because I had already learned those basic moves. And then we're going to work on arm bars. So it wasn't like the professor having to come over and hand teach me every single move because I had already gone through those. So I have to say I was one of the best entries into jiu-jitsu as far as why I started and how I got involved. And so I kind of just fell right in with the troops, very fortunately, and developed that camaraderie much earlier than a lot of beginners would have.
I think that's an awesome story. And I'll tell you, one of the things that my wife struggles with, so being the fact, you know, we're in our beginnings of our 40s. I'm 41, I'll be 42. She just turned 42. She, you know, in our gym, we have a couple of women. Most of them are girls. I'm going to call them girls. They're 16, 17, right, 18 years old. Very, very young. And the guys are, you know, it's definitely a male dominated. And I would say the majority of our guys are wrestlers, ex-wrestlers. They're out of college, never did anything spectacular with wrestling. I mean, you really have to be spectacular wrestling to do anything there. But, you know, they still enjoy the grappling arts. Or there's somebody who, like myself, who just gets into it from a hobbyist perspective. But there aren't many middle-aged women that do this sport. And she's relatively uncomfortable in those training environments. So she does. Vic also teaches our beginner class. And she does a beginner class. And she works with our other business partner, Elisa. She's a purple belt. And she works with her. But it's really funny because, again, Elisa is this really small. She's like 5'5", 130-ish pounds. complete guard player. Like she is super flexible yoga. And my wife is not, she's not athletic in any way. She was a, you know, she was in chorus and choir and music and she's a teacher by trade. So, you know, very different body styles. So my wife has learned how to be like a guard player, and she's really a top side player, but she doesn't have any good training partners to go out and work that stuff with. Excuse me. And oftentimes she feels uncomfortable with the people that are at the gym to train with. And I'm curious, how did you handle that? How did you handle the just myriad of, like, there's nobody that's your body style or type or age. I know when I competed the last, second to last time I competed, it was like one of those oh shit moments for me, because somebody should, it was a younger kid, right? So most of the tournaments around here, they stop at 35 or 30 plus, right? So I'm, again, 41, a decade older. And of course I get the 31-year-old, like, you couldn't have been 29. So I get the 31-year-old wrestler, super strong. And he goes for a shot. I see the shot coming. I post out on his shoulders, and my brain is saying, hips, go back, hips, go back. And my hips are like, nah, we're not ready. I don't want to do it yet. So it was that disconnect of, you know, and it's age. It's your body doesn't react the same way as it used to. So in that regard, like, how do you deal with that training with all these different body styles and body types and that comfortability? What would your advice be to somebody like my wife?
I think when I was at this particular gym, and I got the gym I'm talking about was a Nova Unia affiliate, and it was, made up, like I said, a lot of younger college age surfer crowd, laid back. And to be honest, they were all kind of tall, lanky, the surfer body type. They played a lot of guard. They played a lot of like spider guard, lasso guard, you know, De La Hiva, things that at that point I was 54, 55. And I was able to do, but had I advanced and continued at that gym, I don't think it would have been good for me. So luckily, just for the beginners, I was still learning arm bars and learning takedowns, you know, like, and just learning basic fundamentals. And then I had to relocate. My mother developed breast cancer. And she was in the northern part of North Carolina in a rural area. And I had to resign my job. I found a job at a hospital 20 miles from her and decided that, you know, as her daughter, I needed to be with her because we were going to have to go through the whole gamut of the surgery, chemo, radiation. Right. And I wanted to be there. And so I changed jobs, secured a job, moved to the little town where she was at. Okay, now I got all that settled and I'm taking care of her, you know, as far as like checking in with her. And I have a stepfather too, but I wanted to be close by so I could be with her. I said, okay, it's time to find a gym. Well, there wasn't a gym anywhere in the area where she lived. So I found a gym in a town 40 miles away. And it was a good haul, but I was a blue belt and I had been a blue belt already. So I started commuting to this gym. And remember, this is rural North Carolina. This isn't like where the beach community was a little more bougie. If you want to call that the word.
Good word.
Right. As far as, I go in and I meet with the guy that's the assistant, not the black belts, but I think it was like one black belt and they only had night classes because he worked a day job and he just ran the gym at night. And it was a small gym, maybe 25 to 30 members. And he had a kids program, which probably kept it afloat financially. And it was in a small strip mall. But I went because I said, you know, I'm going to make this work because I really like jiu-jitsu and I'm not going to stop. Well, the first night when I told them, they said, well, first thing, we don't have any women. You're going to be the only woman in here. I went, well, that's okay. I don't mind because I don't really have an option. So I remember going to the first class and he introduced me to everybody. And by now I was becoming out of my shell because I had been gone to a lot of open mats. I had competed some. So I was good at introducing myself and not being afraid. Well, there was no spider guard or lasso guard players. Everybody, the average weight was probably 200. These were cornbread.
That's my kind of gym.
And barbecue and eating boys that lifted hay and stuff like that. I mean, these were homegrown, 200 pounds or above. The smallest person in that whole room was 175 pounds. And there was 150 pounds, 145, 150. So, you know, and they all, there were a couple of blue belts, but I jumped in and they were into half guard, smash and pass, you know, kind
of big guy stuff. Yeah.
So it was totally opposite of what I had gone through as at my previous school. But the thing is, I found that it worked with my mobility issues as I was progressing and getting better and continuing to train. The style that they used worked well for me. And I had always been very interested in deep half guard because I soon found that I, as a smaller person, could sweep people with deep half, you know, or with half guard. And they played a lot of that. So I began working harder at the things that I could do well from the top or from the bottom. So I kind of focused in on work well with my body type and because of their body types. So then when I would compete, even against smaller women that were guard players, you know, I learned how to use my weight. I learned how to put myself in half guard or to do double unders and pass with pressure. So I think I focused my skills, and that school really helped me a lot. It was a Gustavo Machado affiliate, and the professor was Eric Griffin, and it really helped me. I was there for 5 years, and I got promoted to purple belt while I was there. And so I think the thing is that the people that you, depending on what, I don't know if she's in a niche where she has a favorite guard that she plays or top at this point. But what you're asking is, I think that you have to finally, once you hit blue belt and purple, you kind of got to figure out which rabbit hole are you going to go down? What's better for you, your mobility, your size, and try to get really good at that and just know a little bit about the other things and not try to play what the 90 pound girl was playing because it doesn't work for your body. I mean, I couldn't play what a lot of the smaller women play, but I know what works for me. And I guess just depending on the person that I had a lot of wrestlers that are at that school also that were new. And the thing about wrestlers is that they're very uncomfortable when they begin jiu-jitsu just because they're not getting on their back. It's just like they freak out, you know? So
I took a lot. I made that same comment in one of my last podcasts, and I took a lot of heat for that, by the way. So there it is from a black belt. That's the exact same sentiment I said in our last podcast.
It's not anything bad. It's just that the transitioning is a martial art, and it's just a transition. And they have muscle memory that kicks in and tells them to arch, to do everything they can so their shoulders aren't down. And I used to say, just relax, you know, just relax because you're going to sweep me. So I became, even as a purple belt, training with other people. Even though I was older, I would try to talk them through what they were doing wrong, even at the roles and stuff. And I think I said, relax, because what you're going to do is you're going to slip your hand under here and you're going to flip me over. And then I'm going to be on my back and you're going to be on top. So, or when they would get on top, they didn't know what to do. But I'm talking about the beginning wrestlers until they started, you know, learning and picking up skills. But I always found that was like the one thing that was hard. And I think even though it's a martial art, like someone that does judo, transitioning to jiu-jitsu is different. I mean, you know, there are things regardless of whether it's karate or whatever, that there are things that until you get those basic fundamentals down, you're uncomfortable. But I don't mean that. I don't mean that negative about wrestlers at all, because listen,
I didn't either. It's reality, right? I mean, the whole point is just to pin them and you get 3 seconds.
And it's so scary that they've had good training and that they're responding to their training. So I think it's a compliment. It's an indirect compliment.
That's exactly how I meant it.
Nick, everyone just likes giving you a hard time, man.
Yeah. They really do. We've got one guy in our gym. His name is Jake, and he was a D1 wrestler, and he's real long, real tall, really strong. I think he's 21, 22.
Wow.
And I always, always give him crap because I'm like, dude, put on a gi. Let's see what happens. Well, you know, no gi.
He put on a gi once.
And they love, he did, they love one time. The gi. They don't want
to do gi. That's exactly right. Yeah.
All right.
Jake, I'm calling you out again publicly on air here. Jake, get in a gi. Meet me at 5:30 in the morning and let's see what happens. But no, Jake's getting really good. He's been training for about a year now and he's much more comfortable. He could probably kick my ass if we're being honest. But when they first start out.
I'm not a guard puller, but believe me, when I've got a wrestler on the other side, I'm pulling really quick.
I mean, I can wrestle, but
I'm not going to get double blasted across the mat.
If I know it's a lot of work, I'm just pulling guard.
That's what Vic and Jake used to go at it. And they, you know, they literally both go for takedowns, and Jake's just, he's long and tall and it's so hard to take him down. He just has that level change. And again, it's, you know, 20 years of conditioning of doing the same thing over and over again. Yeah. That's what you get, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I just started pulling guard. He didn't like that.
And I think sometimes when you watch wrestlers compete for the first time, like when you go as a coach or part of the team to Nagas or something like that, and they go against another wrestler, it ends up it's like a wrestling match, and I'm going, Mike, you know, you really need to get on the floor get on the ground somehow. So it's a good transition for them, but I never had any wrestling background, and so it's hard being older with hip issues and mobility issues to do a lot of wrestling, but I mean, it's a necessity. So I can level change and I can single leg and run the pipe. And that's about the only two. And then I do an arm drag and a trip, you know, and that's about it. I mean, I don't go very much further than that.
That sounds exactly like my game, right? You just described like everything I level change, maybe not so much. Everything else is I'm not dropping to my knees. I'm too old. I'm too big. Like, I'm good.
I go ahead and tell them when they practice shoots up and down. I went, look, I'm just going to get over here and flex my hip because I can shoot down the mat. And
that's real.
But now I can level change and double leg somebody. I mean, I can do that, which I not just cannonball my head right into their belly and their ribs, you know.
The bull charge. I like that one.
Yeah, I like that. But it's
so, that brings me to a really, really interesting question. How do you feel, or you know, what do you use as tactics when you're training against somebody that's in their 20s, that those spastic, you know, kind of white belt, even to blue belt, or even the ones that are, I can't even imagine as a black belt, right? You've got this target on your back or waist, I guess, of, you know, I need to prove that, and it's not malicious, I don't think, typically. It's I need to prove to the senior belts that I am deserving of the belt that I have or the rank that I have, or trying to prove that I'm ready for the next rank or whatever it is. So they're you know, intentionally going really hard, or you see the opposite, they're being over respectful and not giving you any resistance at all. I think that's what we've heard from different black belts. When you deal with those younger, spastic, just kind of really super aggressive roles, how do you work with that? How do you deal with that?
Well, I've trained for 10 years and I can honestly say I've never had but maybe one injury that kept me off the mat. And it was a really freak thing. It didn't have to do with an ACL or anything, you know, like that. It was like a knee on belly that went wrong and it ended up like bruising my liver. I had like a lacerated liver. It was really weird because I thought I had broken a rib because the pain was so intense, but it was like somebody doing like an MMA, a liver shot. It was like their knee went right under that spot in the rib cage. And
I did that to Nick the other day.
He sure did, right with his knee. He went for,
if it goes right into that right spot, and it just happened. And so that's the only time, honestly, I've ever been injured. But I could tell you, and I help other people, that the type of student that you're describing. When it's time, we have, you know, class where we drill and we drill. I usually try to drill with a partner that is either close to my size or someone that maybe is new, because a lot of times if they are new, but I'm talking about the just drilling, like going through the technique part. Then when it comes to the open mat, I'm going to say, and maybe this isn't a very popular opinion, but it's okay to say no. And I have said no. When people ask me to roll, I have to keep in mind that my longevity and my ability to compete and to continue to compete is by being selective. And unless they're a higher belt and they understand, or they're someone that I know is not going to go hard, but I really don't go, I don't roll with new white belts. I don't roll with people that are from other gyms that I don't know yet or have that trust, because it's, I have to protect myself so that I'm there to show up for my team for the next, for tomorrow. And I think that it's okay. And I think a lot of people, might think it's being snooty or trying to be uppity, but I take it as like I'm older and I'm just not able to go with that. And I think after you've been in jiu-jitsu for 10 years, you can spot those kind of people that you're talking about. And there was a phase when I used to want to roll with everybody. And I think that after you start realizing that you're not gaining anything from it, and when you hit 63, 64, and you know your years are limited and your mobility is starting to be impacted, you want to be good for that Masters Worlds that you're going to go, and you want to be able to compete at Worlds No Gi, you know, so you want to protect yourself. So to be honest, I just say no, and don't roll with people. And I think it's okay to be selective, and I think more people need to accept that, because there are a lot of injuries that happen that are unnecessary because of that. Because I think, like you said, we all know we have egos, and they always say leave your ego at the door, but you know, there are people,
not that easy.
Yeah, it's like a shadow, it follows you.
Yeah.
Even if you're trying to leave it behind.
Yeah. I mean, I don't have an ego, you know, I'm on my own little journey here, and I was given this body, and I started this at an older age, so I've got to protect it. And I will tell them, I'll be happy to drill with you, what we just learned or what we just did, but I can't roll. And that way I feel like I'm offering something, you know, and
that's a really good idea. I did that the other day. There was a guy who he's new, he's a wrestler, he's only been doing it for, I don't know, a week or two, and yeah, just super aggressive, super strong. And to your point, I'm 41, I have a family, I have a career, like I have a profession, uh-huh. I have a wife, I have lots of things. I don't have to prove anything to anybody.
Yeah,
right. If I want to go compete, hobbyists. That's for me to compete.
Our living, you know.
That's exactly like Vic competed in a Kumite. Like he has the shot of making this a career potentially, right? And he's really good. I don't. Like that's the realization. But I had a guy, this wrestler, and he wanted to go super, super hard. And I was like, that's cool. I'm all about it. Why don't we drill something? What do you want to work on? And that's how we ended the open mat, was just working on a couple of things. So we just did that, just kind of drilled at like a 30 to 40% resistance, right? I gave him just enough resistance that he could work, and it was still something to do, but he wasn't trying to take my head off at the same time. So I didn't think of it, didn't click until what you just said, but I think that's a great way. I think a lot of times saying no is hard because you don't want to be the person that says, oh, I don't want to roll with you. Like it's almost pointing that person out and like, well, what's wrong with me? But I like how you kind of phrase that as, well, let's drill. What do you want to work on? Let's just drill that instead of rolling. Yeah. I really like that approach. I think that's really good advice.
Yeah. And you know, I could be just honest and say, you know, I'm not as strong as you. I don't think I would be a good roll, but I'll be more than happy. You know, I bet my technique's better than you, and I can maybe help you with something. You know, I wouldn't say my technique's better, but let me help you with something you had a hard time with. Or I just saw you get trapped in that armbar 2 times on that last roll. Let me show you what you did wrong. Little things like that. I think mean a lot. And it, number one, it helps them. And number two, it protects yourselves. And you both get to come back the next day to train. And that's the main thing. We want to take care of our opponents. I'm really quick to tap also. I know there are people that are, I've seen in Kimuras, and it's like, you're not going to get out of that Kimura. You can sit there, you know, and he's going to rip your shoulder off, but you ain't getting out of it. Go ahead. Yeah. Tap. And so once I know I'm in something that is not, doesn't have an escape route, you know, that I know about, I'll tap. Let's start again. Let's go again.
Well, especially if it's an open mat. What do you have to gain from, you know, hyperextending something? Maybe you do get out of it with a hyperextended elbow. Like, how is that? How's that good?
Well, people that are getting ready to compete sometimes get into that competition mode where they want to go as hard as they would at competition. But that's not the place. I mean, this is not the place, not at an open mat and not against people that you want to come back tomorrow. I mean, I want every one of my teammates and anybody visiting in an open mat to be able to drive home. I don't want us having to call 911 or to go sit in the ER with somebody, you know, or having somebody out of commission. So I think there's a good way to handle it. You have to tell everybody just to chill, you know, go, don't hurt anybody. And don't be afraid to tap. I mean, that's why I chose, I think, jiu-jitsu now that I know more about martial arts, because I don't get hit in the face. And at my age, you got to keep your face as long as you can. It already has problems. It doesn't need any additional damage. And gravity is taking care of that. And, but you want to be able to come back the next day. And I like being able to tap because, I know and I recognize now as a higher belt, when I'm in something I can't escape, or there are arm bars that some of the blue belts can get me in that I pretty much know all I got to do is hitchhike, you know, and get right out of it, or just other things, you know, that you can do that. And it's basic things like they think they have you in a triangle, but you've got both arms in the legs and they don't, yeah, and they're still squeezing. They don't realize that two arms in, you're not going to get it. So,
or if you're a 260-pound, 6-foot guy,
yeah,
with super broad shoulders and somebody constantly tries to triangle you.
Hey, I triangled you the other night. I don't want to hear it.
From a topside triangle after I gave it to you.
No, Nick, you didn't give it to me. Stop messing around.
So Vic and I have this ongoing joke. He tries to triangle me, and I've got a couple of triangle defenses. But it's been cool because every time he gets something, you know, I'm figuring out a way to defend against that piece. And then once I figure out how to defend against that, then he's trying to figure out a way to attack it. And we've been going back and forth for.
Well, that's good. You're both getting better because of it, you know. Yeah. And I think the good thing about that is like I practice the same takedown every time I go to the gym, regardless. And I've been doing it for a year. I do the single leg where I run the pipe. And then I don't do a lot of judo takedown because I think now that I've aged the grips, I have really strong grips, but my joints, my middle knuckles, because I have some arthritis that's starting and I've been having it, but I'm kind of paying attention to it now. And so it's harder sometimes to do a lot of check, but I do a lot of no gi, and you find that a lot of the no gi grips, you know, using gable grips and grips and all on the gi work perfectly fine with me. So, you know, you just adapt to where you are. If it works, it works. You know, I mean, it doesn't have to be a certain way. And that's what I tell a lot of the girls. I usually try, I go to a lunch class with them. It's usually small. Our lunch group is smaller. And a lot of times we have new women that'll come, maybe mothers that are starting and all that as kids go, and they'll come in for the lunch class and I will go with them. And I try to let them know that just because you didn't do it the way our professor showed it doesn't mean that there's not another way to do it, you know, because for myself, I have to adapt certain things. I can't do a bow and arrow choke with throwing my legs over because of the hip mobility, but I have a bow and arrow choke. I just put my knee in the back of their neck and pull. I don't throw the knee over the face.
That's a vicious one too. I like that.
That's rad.
Yeah.
That one's nasty.
Hurts too, you know, and they usually tap, but so, you know, there's being able to be adaptable to using the tools that you have in your toolbox and having, so that way I don't feel left out or anything when we're having a general class, when the professor teaches it a certain way. I think over the years I've known, and I know my body well enough that, you know, I may not can throw my legs over to take someone's back, like, but I know how to pull them into me, you know, so that I can take their back and get my hooks in. So as opposed to throwing my legs in, I have to go to the ground and pull them and then roll them over to the other side to get the other hook in. So there's ways to do it. And as far as like, I think you have to take somebody that's in the class, and I try to find somebody that's near my body size. And if there's somebody that's near her body size, that is really what she's going to face in competition. If she goes to IBJJF, she's going to be in a certain weight class. And even though it may not be a female, you know, you need to learn from that and just tell the person that you're drilling with, you need to, you know, can you help me drill this position? Not roll, but just drill this position. And try to go with someone you're close to your size as possible. And so I get
that's what she's done. She actually went and she got silver at her first tournament ever.
Awesome. So,
yeah. Super excited for her.
Yeah. That's great.
So yeah, it's been cool watching her kind of grow into the sport. So she did more kickboxing, and it was me and my youngest did the jiu-jitsu, and my oldest kind of just floats around and does stuff. But she just, for whatever reason, in the last couple, 6 months, 7 months, she started to really get into jiu-jitsu, and she really started to enjoy it. So yeah, watching her compete. I will tell you though, so watching people compete in your family is way more nerve wracking than competing, from my experience.
Oh yes.
Like, yeah. I can't watch my sister compete. Or I mean, I can, but it's gotten a lot easier. But I remember when Bella first started, I had to like walk away from the match.
It's so hard.
It is very so hard, I guess. I know I had, when my kids played soccer and when they were young, and my son was very good in soccer, and he was on a traveling soccer team that, you know, goes all over the state, and he was a goalie. And that was even, I mean, I probably developed, you know, stomach problems from worrying.
Ulcers.
You're a hero or everybody hates you. You know, it's not that way with the other players, but something about being a goalie, either you're the hero of the game or everyone hates you. And I remember I always had this speech, that ball had to get by 10 other people before it got to you. You know, I would have that little speech thing, but watching was very nerve wracking for even though none of my family does jiu-jitsu. I'm the lone ranger out here.
So I am curious. To people that are over, you know, say 35, right, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, potentially, what advice would you give them to get started? What would you say to them if they're, because I think we hear all the excuses all the time. Oh, this hurts. I'm out of shape. I'm not ready. I'm too old for this.
Let's take my dad for an example.
That's somebody who's trained long enough to get a purple belt. That's a great example. And he comes in and he's, I got this hurts or that hurts. Or, well, yeah, no kidding. We're old. Like, stuff's going to hurt. That's reality. What would you say to somebody? What would you tell Flavia? Let's go with that.
Well, what I can relate to is like when I compete, and let's say at World Masters, they had Jiu-Jitsu Con going on the side, and there are a lot of the families and kids were there. And I would have women or men, and this has happened to me throughout even at small tournaments, as long as I've been competing, blue belt, purple, women would come up to me and go, wow, that's so amazing. I wish I could do what you do. And I would go, well, why don't you? And they go, well, I'm too old. Oh, well, you can't say that to me because I'm older. You know, that's not on the table. Well, because I just don't have time. And I go, you know, if your kids are training, you can make the time. What else are you going to be doing? Netflix, you know, or sitting on the couch? Or you need to do it for your own health. Or someone says, well, I need to lose weight before I come to the gym. Well, I just go, well, that doesn't go either, because, you know, this is a substitute for going to a gym. I mean, how boring is to go somewhere and get on a treadmill and listen to music and not socially interact. I mean, you know, and say you're going to start training when you lose weight. No, you're going to come train so that you can lose weight and do the things that you need to do. And yeah, it's uncomfortable. Yeah, it hurts. But you know what? It hurts more by not going. Like when I miss a day of training, at my hips hurt. It's harder to get up out of bed. The second day of training, if I miss 2 days, I'm really like starting to walk like somebody my age. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm like, I could feel that, you know, I'm not using those muscles that are enhancing and maintaining my mobility as an older person. So it's no different than what a doctor would say to your patient. You need to walk every night after dinner. You need to like maybe start doing some stretching. You need to, you know, be more active. And I think that all those things above is what I try to influence people. But I go, you know, age just has no correlation to jiu-jitsu. There is an entry level for everyone. There is a way to adapt each move for everyone. I mean, we have a gentleman at our gym that is paralyzed from the waist down, but he's in there and he's a blue belt, and he basically has to start, you know, of course, on the mat, and he's able to do arm bars and basic things and uses pressure. And it's amazing just what moves just that he's been able to adapt to do. And it's the same thing with mobility. And saying I'm just too tired or it hurts, you know, yeah, it hurts, but it hurts more not to go. And I think that the weight thing, we have a gentleman that just recently posted, he started, came back as a blue belt, a returning blue belt 1 year ago, and he has lost 90 pounds in 1 year. He's been consistently training 4 times a week, and he has it on a little graph, and he posted the graph on his Instagram the other day. We were all so proud of him because he was really like rolling with Humpty Dumpty. I mean, he was overweight, and and now he's like back into the right range, and he's got a few pounds to go. But and you know, people like Tom DeBlast are constantly posting pictures of people that have, you know, jumped in. So that's the second excuse I think I hear a whole lot. And then the third one is, you know, just like you said, they just don't have time or whatever. And, you know, you just have to make time, because it's kind of like when I wondered, why am I starting this at 54? But it's like, well, what else would I be doing? I mean, I could be sitting there, like I said earlier, at a book club, or I could be sitting on the couch watching TV, or I could take that hour and a half and drive to the gym and train. And the most important component for me, I think, at the stage in my life is, as you get older, things start happening, like your children leave, as I talked about, like the empty nest, or divorces happen, or friends die. I mean, things start happening as you age, as you go on your life timeline. And it's very important to have a community, a social network. It's very important for your mental health. And I think that missing training, I feel that miss, like maybe I haven't been out and around people. And if you're not careful when you live alone or whatever, that kind of thing can sneak up on you. And it's a support system that's there for you. And not just physically, but for your mental health. And I think that that's a very important aspect of jiu-jitsu that is not communicated enough, is that you have this like unspoken fraternal organization that if I was there and I walked outside and let's say my battery was dead, I would have 4 people out there helping me jump my battery. If that happened at Planet Fitness, you know, I'd be flagging down a stranger. You know, it doesn't work that way.
It's funny you say that. We've had, I think, out of the, you know, we've done a bunch of episodes, and I think almost every single one of them has referenced, to your point, the community, the relationships, the mental well-being, and that you call it a fraternal order. that is jujitsu, and it doesn't matter if it's in your gym or even externally, right? Like we've had people that have gone through some pretty big life tragedies, and gyms from just the area have stepped up, and we've seen that time and time again.
Yeah, and we see it all the time when something happens to somebody, like a gym burning down, or you know, got right during the riots and all, people that lost their businesses. Yeah. People put up a GoFundMe, and people from all over, when it gets reposted, if it's not but $5 or $10, they'll throw it in because you have that bond somehow with that person. But it's that bond that I have, like going to the gym every day. It's always a different set of people, same people, but you have that same comfort level that it's like my family or a family that, you know, like going home. And you feel embraced and welcome and warm. And it is something, especially in the craziness that we've been through in the last 2 years. And I think the most important thing that I feel that I can say about jiu-jitsu and that is it is a place where you are welcome on the mats. I don't care if your age, your religion, your ethnicity, your political views. And in this day and age, there's so much of that that divides people. But I think on the mat is somewhere that we can all, it's just having, wanting to get better and having an opponent that wants to get better also, that those things don't matter. I mean, whether that person, and I don't really get into politics. I mean, I have my reasons for certain things, but, you know, and I don't know, I mean, whether the person is vaxxed or not vaxxed, or whether they're pro-vaccine or not vaccine, if they're Republican or Democrat, if they're Muslim or Baptist, it doesn't really matter if they're black or white. I mean, because it's an opponent in front of me and they're going to help me get better and I'm going to get better because of them. And I think it's one of the few sports that you can feel that you bond with everybody across all lines. And I think that is why I have been so grateful to so many people that I have met from all aspects of those things I mentioned and that have cheered for me and for my story. And it went across all lines. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about jiu-jitsu in that environment.
I think we see that everywhere is just the cross section of life. It doesn't matter your background. Nothing matters other than the fact that you want to train jiu-jitsu and you want to get better.
Right.
And as long as you have those two things in mind, nothing. Doesn't matter your body style, doesn't matter your religion, your background, doesn't matter nothing else, age, sex, the whole thing goes out the window. Do you want to train jiu-jitsu? Do you want to get better? Are you a decent human being? Right? Because if you're just a dick in general, like nobody wants to play with you anyway.
Places that I don't probably have that feelings. I mean, I've been places that, you know, I could hear political comments and things like that, you know, and, you know, that's just the world. But I think it is once you're on the mat and rolling, it's all that goes out the window. It's the one safe, it's a safe place for everybody, you know, as far as like not being judged by your views or your weight or your skill level. Everybody recognizes that you're there because you want to get better. And that it's so for all the above, I would say the benefit of all those things is that you're making a really big contribution when you train jiu-jitsu also, because you're helping somebody else too. And I've tried to carry that outside of jiu-jitsu. I mean, outside of my own training into what I do with my company and helping these other young athletes get better so that they can spread the word and all. And I think the jiu-jitsu community is a very giving community. It's a very sharing of knowledge. If you have wealth or some means of helping others, we all share that. And I think it's the sharing of community, and it grows into friendships outside of the gym. Like we have a Christmas party, we have like, you know, a summer, end of summer back to school party, you know, our specific gym does. And many gyms have retreats, cookouts, you know, things like that. So I think it's a
second. That's how Vic and I met. That's
exactly
how I met his dad and his sister. And
yeah,
you know, my daughter's his sister's age. And
yeah, you know, and just, I think the involvement, it gives you a family a home base to come to, you know, where they are welcomed also because they know, hey, that's Nick's wife and kids. We want them to come join us at the pool party we're having, you know, and it kind of just grows from there. So there's a lot of benefits to being involved and helping. And I think that I could not, in the other martial arts, I don't see that, if you know what I mean. I don't see that. Maybe it's because you have to take a rest, a rest roll or sit on the side to rest out and you get to chat with somebody else. But it seems like there's always time to get to know people, you know, even when you're rolling with them or after you're rolling with them, when you have that 2 minute break before the next roll, you know,
when you can talk while you're rolling. I do it all the time. I'll talk to people while I'm rolling.
I usually
say weird things just to kind of distract them. I'll ask them like who their favorite Transformer is or, you know, what their favorite color is, just weird random stuff. But to your point, like you can have those conversations. It does. It really does.
Right. And I try to compliment during open mats or something, you know, you want people, because I had self-confidence problems, I want to try to lift people up. So I find the one good thing that I would try to do is go, wow, you have great pressure. Or, you know, wow.
People tell me that, but just because I'm fat.
But I think it's very important during a role, especially like in an open mat or with your opponent, to say something good about what they did, because I think it really is very uplifting. I know that there were people have done that for me, and because it makes you feel kind of puffed up and good, you know.
Like, a little stall.
Oh yeah, it does.
Yeah, I got killed. You know, I'm a bad. I got badass pressure. You know, I'm gonna really put it on. So you know, it does help their self esteem, and it makes them want to jump back in and do it again. So that's some more advice I would just offer. Yeah. Also,
I love it.
Well, I got one more question for you.
Okay.
What has been your proudest moment in jiu-jitsu so far? Is it your brand Roll Forever that you've done so much? Is it you getting your black belt, you continuing training at your age? What is it?
You know, I have been so blessed with so many great, you know, things. I think, I guess the pinnacle of I was never someone that wondered about the black belt. I mean, I just would show up and train. And I can honestly say that day I had no idea. I had been a brown belt for not quite 2 years. I think I was maybe a month short of 2 years. And it was one of those things that you just, if it happens, that's great. But at my age, it's probably not going to happen because I'm not going to ever be like a Mackenzie Dern or a Gabby, you know, I'm a hobbyist and I'm older and most of the young women in the gym can beat me. The younger women can beat me, but you know, I think it's like apples and oranges. How the professor judges your skills has to be based on what you can do. And are you able to teach that? I may not can do that move, but can I replicate it with dummies or show people the move and teach it, you know, cerebrally be able to execute it. So I think obtaining the black belt was really the highlight. I think it's something that when you start jiu-jitsu and when the blue belts drop out and don't come back, or the purple belt that thinks, God, I've been a purple belt for 3 years, I'm never going to do it, I'm hanging this up, because you know, purple belt was the longest. Four and a half
long haul
at purple. And that is when you really become, you know, you find out who is serious or not about jiu-jitsu is at that level. I think that once you see that person keep coming back and keep coming back. And because it gets to be the second year, the third year, and the fourth year. And, you know, that's when you lose sight of the belt color to me, because it just was like, I'm just learning right now. You know, it just doesn't even seem anywhere. And then when that brown belt happened, I was like, I know I'm going to make it. You know, I know I'm going to get you know, it might be when I'm 75, you know, not 65, but 75, but I'm going to keep showing up because I've been showing up, and all of a sudden that brown belt appeared. So that was very, I think that was the pinnacle of my jiu-jitsu. It was absolutely. And the fact that it was on the stage, you know, you see videos of that happening. And you think, wow, how cool was that? How cool was that? But the fact that I had an opponent my age, I've been going to Masters World since 2015. I have never had an opponent my age. I have always had to drop down to Master 4 or Master 5. And I've always not won, you know, I mean, because I had to give up 15, 20 years. And that's a lot in mobility and flexibility. I've had to go to different weight classes. I think in 2019, there was only one purple belt, and she weighed 250 pounds. And I ended up going in as ultra heavy, or the top heavy, just so I could have a match, just because.
Super ultra heavy. I mean, that's my game right there. Crazy. Super ultra heavy.
250. Yeah, whatever the top, man. The unlimited weight. And yeah. So I'm usually medium heavy. When I was a blue belt, I was medium. And then as I aged, I progressed to medium heavy. And, and, you know, it's like, I'm just going to do it because, I mean, the worst that can happen is I can tap. But yeah. Anyway, the fact that I was a brown belt, and this lady that was a brown belt, and I knew her from a lot of the master ladies groups. She actually had never competed other than small tournaments, but had never done masters, but she was my age, and she was from a different area. She was from the New York area. And she decided to compete. And I was so grateful because finally I had a master. I'm a Master 7. So I was able to compete at Master 7. And, we were different. I think she was medium and I'm medium heavy. So we were very close. So we did our auto gold, you know, auto medaled in our weight class. And then we had our match in absolute. So during the match, she was nervous and I was nervous. Of course, everybody has the jitters, but you know, once you step on the mat, it kind of goes away. And I remember my coaches and team being over there. And the thing is, the Masters matches are only 5 minutes. They, regardless of belt color, even black belts are only 5 minutes. They don't let you go any further. So I thought, you know, if I can jump, and I passed her guard, I got 2 points. And I said, I was inside control. And I thought, okay, I just need to, you know, stay here. But of course you can't stall. And the referee whispered to me, you need to work, you know, didn't give me a penalty, but just made a comment. And I just remember just grabbing her arm and just throwing it, getting a good Kimura grip and just pulling it up. And she yelled tap. And it was like, oh my God, I got a submission. So getting a submission was like, you know, just not even expected. I just wasn't expecting it because I really thought, and I think if that referee not whispered to me that, you know, need to work, I wouldn't have been that aggressive. I think it was kind of like somebody kicking you in the ass, you know, all of a sudden, like, you know, you're in side control. You can't. Now, if I'd been in mount, I could sit there all day, but you can't, you know, in IBJJF at side control, you have to be working on something. So I remember this biggest smile and just sitting up and like going, I submitted her at 2.5 minutes. And so that was like the biggest, my biggest victory, because I won the match and I won by submission. So then we go to the podium, and as on the video, you know, I'm getting my gold. And so I'm so super happy because I had a match in my age and I won, and I won with a submission. So it was like, I had everything. The submission was the icing on the cake. And so when the video comes out where my professor starts dancing and pulls this black belt out, it was just like, I was like, it's like watching yourself that you're in a dream. It's like, it's not really happening. And my emotions were very real. I mean, I was just so overwhelmed that I was deserving of such, and to be there. I mean, it was like the perfect storm, you know, where all the pieces come together but it was like the perfect dream, you know, that came true. But I think in my jiu-jitsu, that was probably the black belt and all those things around it that made it even more special. I think had I got it in the gym, it would have been very special. But I think it was like the icing on the cake of a perfect day. So, I mean, built up to that. And I guess the other thing that of the entire 10 years that I've training, I'm very proud of what Roll Forever, my company, that I decided to do, because it was so important to me to try to give back to the community and to help other people. And I'm one of these people, I'm a caretaker. And so I like helping other people. And it was the best way. And it was a win-win in that it helped the athletes and it helped the community by having seminars locally. They got to bring the athletes in. We got to have seminars, and then everybody got to learn and take it back to their gym. The athletes made a little money so they could go back and train and buy the proper food and nutrition. And it's expensive to be a professional athlete. I mean, on that circuit, I mean, they have to,
especially I was reading an article, not too long ago about the IBJJF, call it purses or, you know, the winnings that people get from those high level matches, and there's no money in it. I forget who it was, but they were interviewing somebody and he said, you know, I can go to an IBJJF competition and I might walk away, I think the top prize is like $6,000, $7,000. And when you train for an entire, as a black belt. Yeah. High level black belt. Right. But if you train for a year, I mean, think about that, a year for less than 10 grand doesn't make any sense. He said, but I can go to other, I can go to other, the tournament styles and, you know, get purses of 20, 30, 40,000. And you know, that the number might sound big to some, but you think about from a professional athlete perspective, when you've got, you know, football players and soccer players and baseball players making multi-million dollar contracts that don't even put their bodies on the line the way that most people in jiu-jitsu do, you know, multi-million versus like 40 grand. That's a very, very different number.
And the ones that train, they probably have 3 training sessions a day. They have strength and conditioning. They have to eat properly. Some of them, you know, have to go to physical therapist, you know, or rehab, you know, not rehab, but whatever, for like massage therapy or whatever to help with their muscles, or use specific equipment. I can't think of the name of those things. They're like pants you put on that balloon up.
Compression, or not the compression, but the
massage,
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I know a lot of them have to use those at night. A lot of expensive things, and the things that drills, it's like pummels your muscles, guns, you know, it looks like a drill. A lot of tools and equipment go in because their body is their occupation. I mean, and they have to take great care of it. And it's like a fancy car or a foreign car. It's expensive and it has to stay well greased and oiled and to maximize its performance. And that's expensive. I mean, you know, if you own a foreign car versus something that's common, like a Toyota, even though it's foreign, a Corolla, there's lots of parts for it. But if you have something like a Jaguar or something like that, you know, you have to go to a specialty shop, you have to have special parts.
I went to a nutritionist and, you know, I was on a weight loss journey, similar to what we talked about earlier. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's a nutritionist or a physical therapist or just regular doctor, they don't all understand what we put our bodies under and what we're looking to achieve. So you go to a nutritionist, they know your standard, you know, caloric intake and your macros and what they should be and everything. But that doesn't take into consideration if you're doing jiu-jitsu twice a day and you're doing strength training in the middle of lunch. Like, that's a completely different lifestyle and you need to fuel your body completely differently. So to find those specialists that really, truly understand the athletic component And if it's nutrition, or to your point, if it's in, you know, like some kind of physical therapy or physical conditioning, or it's all very specialized. So I think, yeah. And of course with specialization comes cost. So yeah. you're not going to go to the local, you know, dietary supplement.
No, you're not going to go to DNC and just grab whatever's on sale. You know, you're going to have something that has this working for you, and you're going to end up. And I know just from some of the athletes I sponsored that they prepare a lot of their own food because they want to use fresh food. They want, you know, a certain amount of greens, certain amount of protein, you know, and they want fresh, you know, red meat, you know, like the Nicky Rod diet, you know, where somebody that can
Nicky Rod.
He's the greatest. But you also think about that they, in order to compete, let's say for the money, like you say, there are money tournaments out there now, especially in no gi. And I think, you know, people like Gordon Ryan and Craig Jones were really breakthroughs as far as starting things happening on the circuit. And Eddie Bravo probably started it with the EBI tournaments, the very beginning, paying people, you know, for every submission you get X number of dollars. He started having travel costs and the athletes had to get there, or in order to compete at like ADCC trials, which were recently down in Atlantic City, it cost. And think about the people that are really good, like the gentleman, Pierre Leclerc or P.O. Leclerc. He competed, but he had to come from Montreal. And so the travel cost to get to Atlantic City, because it's a North American ADCC trial, so Canadians and Mexicans had to go there. And just to get there to compete for the opportunity to do that, or to go to IBJJF in Austin, Texas, or to go down there and be able to train in Austin for a couple of weeks. Now that's kind of becoming the mecca, you know, since COVID has impacted the California, you know, San Diego meccas, you know, and same thing with New York, I guess, depending on your locations, you know, Austin kind of being in Texas benefited from it. I mean, I know I saw Sanju Rivera's gym just opened up this week. You know, he's opened his own gym, you know, down there. Victor Hugo's with him there. So it's just like going places like that now, and as opposed to where it used to, you would go to New York or San Diego or something like that. So just depending on, like you said, your training regimen and things like that. But I think doing Roll Forever and where I've taken it now, because the athletes I have now, right now, two of the athletes I sponsor are going to be in ADCC. Oliver Taza actually won the European trials. He has dual citizenship. And he won the European, so he'll be at ADCC. And Ethan Carlinson got an invite, so he will be there also. So it feels really good to see
the
people that I've helped before they were, I guess, really made it on the scene. I was helping them back do little seminars, you know, in North Carolina and Virginia, you know, and now all of a sudden they're going to be on the world's greatest stage. I don't know if y'all follow, and I'm sure you do, all the stuff going on for ADCC that's coming up in Las Vegas. I mean,
oh yeah, I do. I'm not sure if Nick does, but yeah, I'm excited for it.
You know, I have such a tough time. Even something that I love, I used to be a big football fan. I can't keep track of the people and the records and all that stuff. It's the same thing in jiu-jitsu. Like, I know all the names, I know what they do, but I usually rely on Vic. I'm like, so Vic, what's happening? And he'll give me the lowdown and tells me the whole story.
It's going to be the greatest. And I could tell you, because of my friendship that, you know, that with my friend that, like, I accidentally met at a Naga tournament. I mean, I flew to Finland for the 2017 ADCC. So I was there and I saw Craig Jones for the first time. You know, nobody even knew who he was. And I saw Gordon win and beat Keenan. And, you know, then I went to Anaheim for 2019. So I cannot wait for Vegas. I mean, it's just like, oh my gosh.
And it's awesome that you have the opportunity to do that. That's so cool. That's so cool. Betty, we have one more question. I mean, I could go on all day, hours and hours and hours. This has been awesome. But there is one question we ask everybody. I'd love to hear what you have. So what's one thing you've taken from jiu-jitsu that you've let impact the rest of your life?
That will impact the rest of my life.
Yeah. One lesson that you've learned training jiu-jitsu. And for me, it was the ability to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations. So you know, I that carries over to work and home and everywhere else. Is there one lesson that you've learned that you've let carry over the rest of your life?
Yeah. I think the fact that you, the one lesson I think I've learned is that I've learned to be diligent and when I want something or having a goal and not expecting, being patient and understanding there is no instant gratification, that when you have something that you want, that you have to work for it, and starting as a white belt and going all the way to where I finally achieved black belt was a 10-year, almost 11-year journey. And it was, had its ups and downs, highs and lows. But it was so worth the work and the patience. And if everybody had a goal, whether it be to buy a house or to, you know, own a beach home or something, and they kind of took that aspect that, you know, I found this in my grandchildren, they're always looking for instant gratification. They want something and they want it that second. And I think that understanding you have to put work into getting something to achieve it and to get there and being patient with it and taking the ups and downs. And I think we can all apply that to any aspect of our life and at any age. You know, like one of the things I have, like a bucket list. Everybody has a bucket list, but you know, now that I've kind of like, the black belt was a great thing and I'm so proud of that. But there are other things that are on my bucket list. Like there are places I've never been to travel wise and things like that. They're not going to happen like next week, but I know that with patience and time that they'll get there. And I think it's taught me to be patient and to understand that just show up and train, but have a plan. You know, I mean, just showing up. I've seen people that show up every day, but they are not efficient with their time and they wonder why they didn't get a stripe or they didn't get promoted. But if you can only go 3 times a week, maximize that time and use it wisely. And I think I've tried to apply the same things in other aspects of my life, is if there are things that I need to do, like I'm on this thing now, like I want to start decluttering or downsizing, you know, clothes and things like that. And it's kind of overwhelming, but I kind of got to be patient. I'm just taking one small piece and being really efficient, like maybe doing one closet on 1 week, not even a day, just a week. And can check that one piece off rather than say, I want to declutter all my entire house or apartment or whatever. So learning to, I think, be patient, not expect instant gratification in all aspects, and setting small intermittent objectives to reach a long-term goal. And because that's what jiu-jitsu taught me. And I think you can make that applicable to any aspect. And, you know, the fact that you're contributing to your contribution by showing up every day and training is impacting and helping other people. So it gives them a partner. You show up to a competition, it's giving that person a competitor. And I think that's the other thing also is to, you know, be there for other people. And not only just on the mats, but in ways that you can help each other and try to step up on things that you're capable to do and not outside of jiu-jitsu. I think it's taught me those things.
That's just sage advice, right? I love all the aspects of that, and that being patient and truly understanding where do you want to go and formulating a plan and being specific and being very pointed about what you want to accomplish. I think that's great. And the giving back piece, right? And I think you do that with Roll Forever. It's really cool to hear what not only you've done, but been able to help others do. And I think that's what I really appreciate about everything you've said today. It's just the giving back and the constant helping of the people around you. And I've kind of lived my life by the philosophy of help everyone around me get whatever it is they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll always have the things that I need. And it's been successful. And I think it sounds like you're doing the exact same thing.
Yeah. There's nothing. It's a really giving. There really is something to the, you know, I don't know if it's about Christmas or whatever. There's some saying about, you know, giving is the best part. There is something so rewarding about giving and sharing that to help, especially when that person on the receiving end is appreciative of it. And whether it's knowledge or helping them with a registration fee or putting together something so that they can make money, like putting together a seminar so they can come in and do work, giving them an opportunity to earn money. You know, yeah. It may not be that I'm handing them money, but I'm helping facilitate a way that they can do a seminar so that they can earn some money for themselves. So, you know, and all it takes is a little time on my part. And I'm willing to do that, but I really think being efficient with jiu-jitsu has helped me be more efficient in other aspects, because I've seen people that come to the gym all 5 days or nights and they're just there and they are chatting some of the time, they're cutting up or rolling, and then they wonder come when it's promotion time why they didn't get that strike. And then I see the people that come 3 times a week that are 100% listening to the professor, that when he says, okay, now let's drill it, they don't just drill it 2 times and stop and chat. They drill it till he says, okay, time for the next move. So I think, like you said, learning to be efficient and with the time that you have and using it to the best helps your progression in other aspects other than just jiu-jitsu.
For sure. Betty, again, this has been amazing. And again, I could talk all day, probably into tomorrow with you. I think your journey has been fascinating. I think, you know, you inspire me. You truly do. At 41 years old, I look around my gym and I see a bunch of 20-year-olds and I'm like, what am I doing here? And then I see you and what you've done.
You got to come train if you're ever in the Virginia area or Norfolk. My gym is at Virginia Beach, but I travel a lot. Now that I'm retired, when I worked at the hospital, I had one of these wonderful jobs. I worked 7 days and I was off 7. So I relocated to Virginia once my mother healed and had a great outcome. And so I relocated to Virginia because I had some friends up here and started training with Diego a little over 3 to 4 years ago. So, you know, that part of the story is how I landed in Virginia. And, very close to my mom. I'm only 2 hours away from family. And it's great, but the job allowed me to travel. So I love getting in the car or either getting on a plane and going somewhere and competing or going somewhere just as a spectator or going somewhere to an open mat or to a tournament and watching people. So you never know. I may show up. You know,
I was gonna say if your bucket list if your bucket list includes travel to Cincinnati, which I don't know why it ever would, but if it does, please, I'd love to have you come into our gym. It'd be absolutely amazing, and certainly if we're in that area.
Now, your gym is exact. Tell me the exact location again, so I'll know.
So it's in Florence, Kentucky.
Okay.
Northern Kentucky. So I don't know if you know Nick Albanes, Chewy.
Yes.
So Chewy is also Team Sean Hammond's affiliate. He's about an hour-ish south of us in Louisville. We're north of that.
And I'd love to come. I'd love to come visit too.
We'd love to have
you. Betty, we need to make it a dual seminar, like Betty Broadhurst doing the gi portion and him doing the no gi portion. I said, the person that books that.
We can make that happen. That's
what I was saying. I was like, well, you know, you're setting up all these seminars. When do you do a seminar?
Yeah.
I guarantee there are people that want to learn from you.
I'm telling you, that's what Oliver Taza actually told me. He said, Betty, you don't realize that. And I guess I didn't know. I got a phone call like at midnight from one of my friends. She said, your picture's on Joe Rogan's Instagram. And I'm like, what? You know, and I didn't even know, you know, and that he had gotten news and reposted it. And that's when everything kind of hit, you know, because of his popularity. But anyway, Oliver is one of my you know, superstar athletes. And he, and I've set up many seminars for him. And he said, now that you've got this notoriety, or that people know that people your age can do it, Betty, you need to do a dual seminar. Like, we go together, which I always go with them a lot to set up, taking care of the admission and all that. And he said, you could actually do one for like people in giddy, older people, women, whatever, you know, I don't would do a women's only. And then I'll do the no gi part, because not everybody does no gi and not everybody is old. And, but I mean, you know, but it, a lot of beginners like to come to my class. I've been teaching class at lunch just because for the gi. I show, you know, more of a simplified version of how to do things, like I said about the bow and arrow choke and things like that, to, until you start getting more advanced. I think sometimes basically fundamentals are really good. But yeah, I went to Grapple Fest in England right after Masters Worlds. It was like a whirlwind because three of my athletes were on that card, Nick Ronan and P.O. Leclerc and Oliver. He went against Dante. So I flew with them. We all went over to England. It was in Liverpool. And I'm telling you, this was only 5 days. It was the weekend after I had gotten my black belt. I was treated like a celebrity. There were people like coming up their photo from London. I mean, in England, and they were bringing me drinks. And I was like, I was just here to be a spectator, just to watch the guys I sponsor compete. So there might be something to this. I haven't done a seminar, but
there is. It's inspirational. I'm telling you, it is absolutely.
Yeah, people
when I
are
saw
gonna
it.
Want to learn from you.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean,
well, you know,
like I said, I saw it, and it was just like, oh my gosh.
On the map, you know, we could say this is the first time BJJ Betty and Oliver Taza or Ethan Curlinson are doing a dual seminar, you know, do two for one.
I think we need to make this happen.
Yeah,
I think
for sure.
Really gotta happen.
That's just, tell me when and where, you know, and we'll be there. Not a problem.
Yeah. We're gonna figure that out on Monday.
I'll roll with everybody that's safe, that y'all tell me that's safe.
We'll point out the ones that aren't. We'll have Vic take care of them. He'll just intercept and be like, you don't want to roll with me.
They roll with everybody too if they're healthy. You know, like afterwards, they always roll with everybody.
That's awesome.
Ethan's recovering, he'll flow roll with people. But sure. Nick Ronan is really good. He's right up in the New York area. But if you have any no-gi geeks, and I'm a real no-gi geek, and I love the gi, but the no-gi is where I'm best. I mean, I can heel hook somebody in about 5 seconds. It doesn't take me long.
Oh, I got to learn that.
That's so badass.
I got to learn that.
I love my favorite submission in the gi is a straight ankle lock. I mean, it's just, I just love getting that foot and just stretching it out as hard as I can, you know. But I've had some good, the benefit of, I think this is that I get to train with some of these guys. As one of my girlfriends says, how come there's always these pictures of you with these hot guys? You know, I said, all I do is train. Maybe I should start training jiu-jitsu. I said, listen, maybe you should, because there are a lot. But I could tell you that, you know, all I want from them is to learn that body lock pass, you know, or, you know.
That's the new sales pitch for jiu-jitsu right there.
Oh, right. Man, that's
great. Not after anything else. That's what I'm wanting. I want awesome. The jiu-jitsu knowledge. It's been great. Thank y'all so much. This has been fun. It's been a great.
Oh, thank you. This has been amazing. And I will say,
I've really enjoyed it.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so cool.
I know. And I will be competing at PANS, by the way. Coming up. And I actually have a match. There's a Master 7 black belt. She's been a black belt.
So how long? Awesome. Do you know how long she's been a black belt for?
3 years.
Okay, so that's not awesome. So we've got a friend of ours, Russ Kenny. He's 51, I think.
Something like that.
He's a black belt. He just got his black belt last year. And he went to, was it PANS or Worlds? I forget. I think he went to PANS.
PANS.
And he's done a couple other tournaments, but in PANS, you know, the guy he was going up against had been a black belt for longer than he'd been training. But once you get the black belt, like, it doesn't matter how long you've been training, you're a black belt. That's it. There's no division.
Yeah, I was going to say, right? So this girl could have been a black belt since she was 25.
Right.
She's still,
right.
she's 60, so she's 5 years younger than me. But she's only been a black belt 3 years. She was a late starter also. So, awesome. You know, I don't care. It's a match, and I'm excited.
That's awesome.
I know.
Awesome. Betty, again, we've been together for almost 2 hours. This has just been amazing. I can't believe it's been this long. This is the longest one we've done so far. It's just so much fun. But truly awesome, truly amazing. And I'm so humbled and grateful that you're willing to come on our podcast and our show and talk to us, spend your time. So
really appreciate it.
You know, I'm really glad to get to know more people and spread the word. And, you know, it's like we all have the same goals. We all want to get better and get to know each other. And we all want to help each other. You know, I want to help athletes get better because I want to make the sport kind of like what Mo Jassim is doing. I mean, I really want the sport to grow to where these guys get paid, you know, for what they're doing. Because like you said, I mean, the work they put in, nobody knows what their body's going through. And then for so little money. So even though I'm just a hobbyist, I mean, having what happened to me at my age, I never thought it would be that it would create the media hype or whatever it did, but I'm really glad it did because it gave me a forum, you know, to speak on a lot of other issues that I have a opinion and I'm an advocate for. So I really appreciate you giving me the time and opportunity to speak so much.
For sure. Thank you so much. This has been awesome. So thanks. Hey guys, thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed. This has been an amazing time and we'll talk to you later soon. Thanks so much.